This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multi-mineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I missed anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening, you sexy little people, and even you large people out there. This is the Tim Ferriss Show, and in this episode, I will be having a long discussion, and I hope it is an interesting discussion with Ryan Holiday. I've known Ryan Holiday for quite a time now, since 2007, South by Southwest. That is when we first met, and he has helped me with a number of my book launches, including The 4-Hour Body and quite a lot of The 4-Hour Chef. He is very, very clever, very unorthodox, and he got an early start. He is known as a media strategist for controversial clients like Tucker Max, bestselling author and founder of American Apparel, Dove Charney. He dropped out of college at 19 to apprentice under Robert Greene, known for the 48 Laws of Power and other bestselling books, went on to advise many other authors, multi-platinum musicians. He is director of marketing at American Apparel, where his work has been profiled all over the place, and he's had to deal with everything from lawsuits, scandals, huge opportunities, and everything in between. His strategies and approaches in handling good and bad situations have been used as case studies by Twitter, YouTube, Google, on and on and on and on. He is a good friend, very smart, very in control. We'll delve into tactics, philosophy, his new book, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy it, and thank you for listening. Optimal
minimal. At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
The Tim Ferriss Show.
So Ryan, to start off, I suppose we could talk about our mutual love of stoicism and how we both fell into the throes of philosophy, but
yeah.
For many people, I think they number one, don't know perhaps the origins of how you encountered stoicism. I remember one of your friends, one of our mutual friends, telling me about how you were one of the odd ducks out who was fascinated by stoicism in high school. I think that is part of the story, but maybe you could give us a little bit of background on how you ended up encountering all these various characters historically and getting into it.
Yeah, it was weird. It actually wasn't in high school. I was in college. I was writing for a newspaper, and I got sent to this conference that Dr. Drew Pinsky, like, he has a show on HLN. He's the host of Loveline. He was like leading this private session with college journalists about, and I So I sit through the whole thing, and then after I walk up to him, and I don't know what possessed me to do this, but I asked him if he had any books that he would recommend, because he seemed like a very smart person who read a lot. And he was like, you know, I'm reading this book about this philosopher named Epictetus. And it's a philosophy known as Stoicism. I think it's really good, and you should check it out. And so I went, and I, you know, I bought it on Amazon. I still have like the Amazon receipt, so this would have been like 2006. So I bought it, and then I bought this other book called The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, which Amazon like suggested, you know, when they link purchases. And the this was before Amazon Prime, so Marcus Aurelius comes first. And I sit down and I read it, and it just, you know, totally blows my mind in the way that like a book can blow the mind of a 19-year-old boy, I guess. Tyler Cowen calls them like quake books, like books that sort of shake everything. And it was that for me. It was like this book that totally turned my whole life upside down. And at the time, I just got dumped by this girl that I dated for a super long time. And I was, you know, like deciding whether I wanted to do this college thing or not. And it was just this book that was like, it was the perfect book at the perfect moment. And it's philosophy, yes, but as you know, it's philosophy that you can actually read that helps you with actual problems that you're dealing with. And so it was the perfect thing. And I got introduced to it by the guy who does calls about STDs on the radio at like from midnight to 2 a.m., which is not what I would have expected, but you know, the rest is history.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually had no idea, which is hilarious given how much we've talked about this type of thing before, that was how you're introduced to all of this. So Dr. Drew also deals with, is very involved with a number of nonprofits that deal with, say, heroin addiction. And, mm-hmm. I can imagine why he would pick that book up. As a side note, what year of college was this, if you remember? And secondly, not the year itself, but were you freshman, sophomore, et cetera? Secondly, how was Marcus when he was penning this notebook, I suppose, that became Meditations? And then lastly, what type of decisions did you make as a result of reading the book?
Yeah, sure. So I was just starting my sophomore year of college, and I ended up dropping out at the end of that year. And I think we met, if I remember correctly, like a few months later. And you quote Seneca in the 4-Hour Workweek, and I think that was one of the things that we connected by. So it sort of all was happening at the same time. But Marcus Aurelius, he wrote Meditations, as far as I understand, while he was emperor. So he would have been in his 30s and 40s. He died fairly young. We don't know we don't know how long he was writing the book. Like there's a few places that allow historians to date it somewhat, but we don't know like what each specific meditation was referring to or why. We just know that he was writing them usually at night during what would only be a very stressful job that you would have to decompress about every day.
Right.
And so for me, I like, you know, when you go through a breakup, you are usually you're angry, but then you're also sort of not self-loathing, but you feel crappy and worthless and you don't know what to do. And so for me, it was this idea of like, look, get off your ass. This like you can make the best of this situation. Like, what are you going to do about it? One of the things that I did when I read this book was it sort of sent me down this path of other things to read. Like he says in the book, he says like sort of go directly to the seat of knowledge in terms of like how to learn. Mm-hmm. And so he actually says like throw away your books, go directly to the seat of knowledge. So I sort of did both. I went and I read every book that I could about philosophy, about life, biographies, and that set me, you know, I've read hundreds and hundreds of books since then. But I also, you know, snagged these mentors that showed me like real life, and they taught me things in person. And I think that's when I learned that this idea of philosophy and like a life of doing things and being successful and working were not at all mutually opposed. I think a lot of people find philosophy and it just sends them down this rabbit hole of books and they get further and further removed from reality as a result. And so right. That this did not have that effect for me.
And how would you, I feel like philosophy, we talked about this when I originally proofed early, I guess, drafts of The Obstacle is the Way, your latest book, that, you know, philosophy, selling philosophy is problematic, right?
Sure.
Because I think the term for most people conjures an image of the schmuck in Goodwill Hunting in the bar,
sure,
who's paraphrasing literature without giving any credit, or some like tortured graduate student at NYU who loves to sort of quibble over semantics of words that really, at the end of the day, the argumentation is just a lot of fancy tail chasing. And that's, I think, a very mainstream interpretation of this word philosophy. How do you view philosophy? How do you present it to people so that it's palatable or attractive?
Yeah. So when I sat down to write the book, I totally empathize with that. No one wakes up and says like, "Hey, like I need philosophy." They say, you know, "I have this problem and I need a solution to this problem." Well, it turns out that historically that's what philosophy actually was for. Specifically Stoicism. Like there's a great quote from Henry David Thoreau where he says like, you know, to be a philosopher is not about like having subtle thoughts or founding a school. It's about solving the problems of life, not theoretically, but practically. And I think the Stoics understood that much earlier, you know, like 2,000 years ago. Cato, who you've written about, was considered to be a philosopher, but not because he wrote anything down, but because of how he lived his life. You know, Socrates didn't write anything down. Epictetus, we only have his lessons because a student of his wrote them down as notes. Mm-hmm. And Marcus Aurelius is like, you know, he wanted to be a philosopher, but he was in line for the throne. And so he had to mix his philosophy with being the most powerful man in the world. Mm-hmm. And so what I think is really interesting about Stoicism, and I talk about this in the book, is when you look at it and you see that it has this, it tends to have a resurgence when times are really, really bad. So like, Stoicism was very popular during the American Revolution. Like, George Washington, read the Stoics as a teenager at Valley Forge. He actually put on a play about Cato, which is one of the most popular plays in the world at that time. Thomas Jefferson died with a copy of Seneca on his nightstand. And then during the Civil War and in the Victorian era, you saw another resurgence of Stoicism. Stoicism was big during the American Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, and then you know. It was also like Marcus Aurelius was living in the decline and the fall of the Roman Empire. Like it doesn't get much worse than that. And so it's basically at its core, it's this philosophy that says like you don't control the world around you. You only control your response to that world. And so that's a very practical and beneficial philosophy when a lot of things are happening around you that you wish weren't happening.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes perfect sense. I can't recall how I was first introduced to Seneca specifically. I had read at some point or been forced to read, I'm sure, some excerpt of, say, Epictetus or Meditations, probably in college. And as with most things you're forced to do, most likely did not find a lot of joy in it. But Seneca really grabbed me, and I don't want to go into a long story of why that's the case. But so you have this, let's just call it the trifecta of Stoicism, or the big three, right? You have Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, Seneca. It seems like Marcus is primarily your guy. I don't know, but I've been very curious to see how different people resonate with different Stoic thinkers. And I'm curious, number one, who your primary influence is. And secondly, why you think that is and how you think different people are attracted to different Stoic thinkers.
Sure. Well, it's interesting too about philosophy. Like most people are never forced to read the Stoics because professors don't like them as much because there's not as much room for interpretation. Like it's pretty straightforward. and right. I think that's why you like Seneca. I like him as well. It's like he says these sort of very timeless eminently practical truths in a straightforward, clear way. And they talk about it in the context of like our actual problems. Like they talk about, hey, like, you know, Seneca will be writing a letter. It's like, hey, like, you know, I heard like your wife died. Like, here's some advice.
Yeah. I hear you're getting slandered in the Senate, or there's a lawsuit pending.
Yeah.
Here are my thoughts. Yeah.
Totally. Totally. So I like you, I lean towards Seneca, but also Marcus Aurelius, because they were two, like Seneca was one of the most financially successful men in Rome. He was an advisor to Nero. He was a sort of famous tutor and playwright, but he was also skilled at investments. So he was very financially successful. So when you read his stuff, he's dealing with the sort of the same timeless problems that anyone who has success or works in business deals with, you know, bad markets, you know, luxury. You know, he's just sort of dealing with all the temptations of business that he's talking about. So I like him a lot as well. Personally, I like Marcus Aurelius. I like the notion. Like, what's so fascinating to me about him is he was literally the most powerful man on earth. Like, he was worshipped as a god in his own lifetime. He could do whatever he wanted. And you read this book that he wrote primarily for himself, and it's just like notes about self-discipline, about being a good person, about like forgiveness, about, you know, honor, about treating people well. That's where I like it. I get the most practical benefit in terms of like leadership and you know, self-awareness and stuff like that. So that's why I like Marcus Aurelius. Although I will say, I think it's funny, like you read this book and at the beginning, Marcus Aurelius is like sort of thanking all the people who like gave him lessons, and like one of the lessons he learned was like not raping his slaves. So it's like it's sort of pretty. It's on the one hand, it's very relatable. Like, he congratulates himself for never having laid a hand on his slaves. So you can sort of take a, it gives you a pretty clear idea of what he's alluding to there. But you realize like it's very relatable, but then also very foreign at the same time.
Right.
But you know, I mean, what other person in that position do we have a document about their thoughts? Like, when you could literally do anything you wanted without repercussion, here's a guy like writing notes to himself about, you know, being a good person, not taking advantage of everything that he could take advantage of, you know, not like forgiving people and all this stuff, which I take a lot of personal value out of. And I think his writing is so clear and straightforward, and it's written in this sort of, it's written in these epigrams that are easy to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Epictetus is great too. He's a little more lectury.
Yeah.
And because he was a teacher, you're getting the lectures.
Gets into the cosmos a bit too, and in some pretty esoteric ways that aren't immediate. They're more abstracted, I think, more professor friendly for interpretation.
He's the most religious of the philosophers, of the Stoics as well. Which, personally, not being a religious person, doesn't have the same amount of relevance for me. Like, when you read Marcus Aurelius, he's not talking about like Zeus and stuff,
right.
Which, you know, I think makes it feel a little bit more relatable. And it's definitely the same is true with Seneca. Like, if you'd never heard of Seneca and someone took his works and translated them and took out all the anachronisms, you could very easily fool someone into thinking this was written like in the last decade.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, that's that for me was critical. And I mean, the way that I try to define philosophy for people who have never read philosophy or who have been put off by philosophy as they perceive it is, you know, this is an operating system for making better decisions in your life. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it so incredibly powerful. You mentioned something just a moment ago about Seneca being one of the wealthiest people in Rome, if not the wealthiest at one point. I mean, extremely shrewd investor, investment banker, financier. And let's talk about Stoicism for a second, because the word Stoic or Stoicism has developed modern connotations that I think perhaps turn people off of mm-hmm. the concept of studying something or reading something called Stoicism. And I remember a quote, I don't remember the attribution, which was, you know, most people face life with the same Stoicism of as a cow standing in the rain. And I think that people, a very common perception of Stoicism, and perhaps this is true for some people, I mean, Cato seems the most kind of Spock-like in a lot of ways, is that you feel neither pain nor joy. You are just basically a cyborg. And the goal is to not experience emotions whatsoever.
Right.
And, also I think people perceive it as, asceticism or foregoing right. all of your worldly possessions. And of course, Seneca was very highly criticized and continues to be highly criticized as, you know, the opulent Stoic. Like, how can he talk about foregoing riches or, and I'm kind of laying this one up because I've obviously read right. a lot about this, but, I'd love for you to talk about how you would reconcile some of those things. Like, does Stoicism, is it compatible with material or financial success or being famous, or are they completely at odds with one another?
Sure. Well, look, I think since both of us are authors, we can very much relate to the problem that's happened with the Stoics over the last 2,000 years, which is it's a bunch of people psychoanalyzing people they've never met based on their work. And right. and over the generations, it builds on itself. And the problem is, what they're forgetting is that the Stoics it's a philosophy that's designed to solve certain problems, and specifically only those problems. So, you know, Marcus Aurelius isn't writing notes to himself at night that says, like, hey, like, women are really pretty, don't forget, or like, hey, you should laugh and have a good time, or like, you know, money is nice. Like, no one needs like a reminder of certain things, right?
Right.
And specifically, since he was not writing a book for other people, he was writing a book for himself. You can safely assume that he's writing reminders to himself about the things that he's particularly bad at, right?
Right.
And so it's a deliberately selected view of a person who's struggling with tough things in their life. He's not, again, trying to explain a systemic worldview that you should keep in mind. He's working through problems in his own personal way. Mm-hmm. And maybe if Seneca had had different friends that were really somber and sad all the time, he would have written them different letters. Like, Cicero was a Stoic or studied Stoicism, and there's more joy in his writings. Maybe just because it was a totally different situation. So what I want people to keep in mind is that Stoicism is not about being sad or not having emotions. It's about keeping an even keel and not getting upset or delusionally happy either. And so I actually think there's a core tenet of optimism in Stoicism. Like,
yeah.
I called the book The Obstacle is the Way, and it's based on this exercise from Marcus Aurelius where he's saying, like, look, it doesn't matter if you're trying to do something and you get blocked. This is actually an opportunity to practice virtue. So, like, basically what he's saying is, like, hey, I know this thing that happened that you think is bad. It's actually good, and it's actually a chance for you to do good things. To me, that's like, that's cheerful and that's happy, and that's the kind of attitude of someone who never gets depressed because right. they always feel like they have a way out.
Right.
And what the Stoics were saying is, like, if you go around thinking that the world is great and that it's always going to work out exactly how you plan and that people are always going to treat you well, like in one of the things, Marcus reminds himself that tomorrow when he wakes up, people are going to be rude, they're going to cheat, they're going to steal, they're going to argue with you, they're going to do all these things. He's doing that so he can go out and interact with them in a positive way rather than feeling let down and pissed off all the time.
Right, right.
So I think that's super important, and I think that's something that's totally been missed from Stoicism, and I think that's why you and I are attracted to it and find value from it in our lives. It's not like confirmation of our pessimism or cynicism, and on the contrary, I actually feel like it's intimately connected with being happy and fulfilled as a person.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't think it was a contradiction at all that that Seneca was successful and seemed to genuinely enjoy his life and was, you know, had financial riches. I think Nassim Nicholas Taleb is another person. It's the point is, making money is usually a result of being successful or good at something. It can also be a result of luck or fortune. And having it doesn't say anything good about you, and it doesn't say anything bad about you either. And the only problem that really comes from wealth, well, there's a couple problems, but being financially successful and I'm not a millionaire, but I'm doing well. There's temptation to, you know, spend money on, you know, negative things, let's say. But the real problem is thinking that you need this money to survive. And so it's funny, like, Seneca has this reputation for being opulent, but in Letters to a Stoic, he talks about actually practicing poverty, like one day a month, pretending that all his money was stolen or lost and that he's walking the streets as a homeless person. He's doing that so he can enjoy his wealth while he has it, but never feel like it's integral to his survival or, you know, existence as a person either.
Right, right. No, it's been, I think, you know, not to bring Fight Club into this, but, you know, the things we own end up owning us. And I think there's a big difference. And this might actually be a Thoreau quote, who had his own contradictions like we all do.
Yeah.
I heard he used to sneak off and have big meals at Emerson's house while he was at the, at Walden. But, and that is that, you know, the problem is not having riches. It's when riches have you. And
totally.
I think Seneca, comments on that quite extensively. And, you know, the problem is not having wealth. It's when it becomes a source of sort of fear and greed, and it dictates how you behave, as opposed to being a tool. Therein lies the problem. So besides obviously these fantastic works of literature, or I suppose that might not even be a fantastic label. I mean, in some cases, they're war journals of sorts.
Right.
Coming back to seeking out mentorship in real life, teachers in real life, was Robert Greene really the first person to take you under his wing in that way, or are there was there someone else who was sort of a pivotal teacher to you?
Sure.
And how did that come to be?
Yeah. So actually, before I met Robert, I was working with Tucker Max, who we both know.
Right. And Robert, of course, just to give some context, maybe you could explain, give some context on both of them.
Yeah. So Robert Greene wrote The 48 Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, and The 33 Strategies of War. And then I met him in, you know, 2006, 2007. I was in college. I met him through Tucker Max, who's another number one New York Times bestselling author, sort of known as a really good sort of internet marketer and thinker, and then also a, you know, does crazy things. But I met Tucker showed me about marketing. He introduced me to Robert. Robert really showed me about writing and researching and learning. And I worked with Robert on his last two books. He wrote one called The 50th Law, which is about fearlessness with the rapper 50 Cent. And then he wrote one called Mastery, which is about, you know, becoming a master at whatever it is that you do.
Yeah, great. Book.
Yeah, I love it. It was like an honor to be a part of it. So those were my two mentors in like sort of direct mentorships. But I also think, like, you know,
how did you, just to, not to interject, but how did you, just in the sort of the details, the nuts and bolts, how did you initially connect with Tucker Max? How did you initially?
It all goes back to this college newspaper. I was writing, I had a column there, and I decided I would use it to as an excuse to write articles about people I wanted to meet. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a review about Tucker's website, and I emailed it to him, and we just started this relationship, and then I would just email him and ask questions. So it's funny, I think you probably see this, like, people think mentorships are these like very official relationships, like the way that an apprenticeship was like your parents basically sold you to someone in exchange for like room and board for a certain number of years, and then you officially learn a trade. Like, a mentor is anyone who you learn from, who gives you advice and teaches you things, and you don't actually have to meet them for them to be your mentor. Seneca talks about this. I forget who he's talking about, but he says, like, you know, find yourself someone that you can use as like a benchmark or a ruler to compare yourself to, so you can decide when you have, you know, difficult choices, like, what would this person do in this situation? How would they act? What should I do here? And so, like, I would even say you are definitely one of those people. Like, we don't have some official mentor-mentee relationship, but, like, you've taught me so much, and I've asked you questions, and hopefully, like, you know, it's gone both ways. But, like, you're older than me, you're more successful than me, you've taught me things, and that's what I think a mentorship is. And you can have that with basically anyone. I think a lot of people, they hold out for this, like, sanctioned official relationship rather than just like learning from anyone who has wisdom or advice or value that they could pass your way, and if you put it into practice and you do something with it, they see value in that as well.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I appreciate the kind words, obviously.
Like, you were the one who, like, I was studying Stoicism. It was interesting to me, and I think I mentioned it to you. And then you encouraged me to write an article about it for your site, which sort of set me down this whole path to begin with. And so I think, you know, it's weird how these little conversations can have such a big impact on your life. But it just depends on, I think, you know, how people respond to and treat the opportunities that they get that often don't look like opportunities when they, you know, sort of first make their appearance.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Jack Canfield, who co-created Chicken Soup for the Soul, is largely responsible for the 4-Hour Workweek becoming a book. And It was just one or two offhand comments that he made to me that were encouraging in the early days that produced the proposal, because it coincided with a bit of downtime. And he effectively helped force my hand by making introductions that led to conversations with agents. And it's incredible how, in the case of Jack, you know, he became a mentor to me because, very similar to the newspaper, I used volunteering for tech nonprofits as a way to meet the people I wanted to meet, because these events would put on these organizations like the Silicon Valley Association of Startup Entrepreneurs, it's a mouthful, but SVACE, or TAI, the Indus Entrepreneur, put on large events every few weeks or every quarter. They'll have an event where they bring in thought leaders and their panels and so on. And so I volunteered for SVACE when I first moved to Silicon Valley in 2000, and really just kicked ass as a volunteer for a few months and continually took on more and more and more responsibility until I was invited to sit in on the board meetings, just as an observer, basically. And they were talking about their next main event, I think is what they called it. And I just kind of raised my – they're like, well, who are we going to get to do this and manage the event and wrangle the speakers? And I just kind of shyly put up my hand, and I was like, I'll do it. I'll take care of it. And so they handed it over, and I put together a panel. God, what was it called? It was called something like, you know, Titans of Consumer Products or something. And I invited, you know, the creator of the Clapper and the Pet Rock. I invited the guy, Ed Bird, who is sort of the jointly responsible for popularizing creatine in the United States as an athletic supplement, which was a huge, huge deal. The founder of Clif Bar, Jack Canfield, and so on and so forth, and got to know Jack by inviting him to this event and having a bunch of emails back and forth. And then over the years, you know, asked him every once in a while, pretty rarely, would ask him very specific, short, kind of life questions. That's how the whole thing came to be. So in the case of Tucker, for instance, how long after you initially introduced him to the article you wrote, did you start asking questions? Over what period of time, you know, how frequently did you email him? I think this is something people need to understand, because asking someone to be a formal mentor is like the absolute best way to never have a good mentor.
Totally.
Because it's like, hey, you want to sign up for a unpaid part-time job because you have so much free time? It doesn't work. So I'd just be curious to hear sort of what you did and what you would recommend people do if they're trying to find or looking for that type of teacher. I think mentor is problematic because they think of it in such formal terms, but what, maybe you could talk on that point.
Yeah, totally. I think it was like, it was once every couple weeks, a couple months probably. And I would just ask like questions that I thought, would be helpful to me, but very easy for him to answer.
Right.
And that's what, you know, it's like, hey, if you want me to read your manuscript, that's like a lot of work for me to do.
Yeah.
Or this would be more for you. If someone wants you to read their manuscript, you're like, okay, that's like a week of my time. Yeah. If someone wants you to give a 5-second instant opinion on a title, you're like, sure, that's one email.
Right.
And so I think people don't think, one, they don't think about, you know, what they're actually asking. And then two, they ask a lot over and over again. When really, it's actually interesting. There's this thing called the Ben Franklin effect. I don't know if you know this story, but...
about the lending library or the...
Yeah,
why don't you tell the story? This is such a great story.
So Benjamin Franklin, there was this member in Congress, or one of the things about the American Revolution, or I don't really remember where it is actually, but Benjamin Franklin faced this sort of enemy in a legislative body who he desperately needed his support, and they seemed to be intractably opposed to each other. And what Benjamin Franklin did was he heard that this guy loved rare books and had a prized library of rare books, one book that he valued above all the others. So Ben Franklin, being a somewhat bold man, walks right up to this guy and just asks him if he can borrow his most prized possession. And the guy, sort of like stunned, is like, I guess. Benjamin Franklin borrows it, just puts it on his shelf for like 2 weeks, doesn't touch it, doesn't use it, and then returns the book to the guy. And what he finds is that having borrowed this guy's most prized possession, they now have not only the shared connection, but the guy has to justify in his head why he would loan this thing that's so valuable to someone else. And so he starts to tell himself this story that Benjamin Franklin must be good. He must be someone worth loaning this thing to, sort of using cognitive dissonance to your advantage. And basically it's been verified, by psychological studies since then. It turns out that when you do someone a favor, you actually feel indebted to them, you would think that doing someone else a favor would make them indebted to you. In fact, asking something small of them in some ways can build a better connection because now they're like invested in you. And I would try to ask questions or think about things that they would like and that they would, you know, feel like they got value out of too. And that's something that, you know, it's like a subtle psychological shift that people miss for some reason.
Yeah, it's Ben Franklin's such a fascinating character. I really enjoyed reading Walter Isaacson's biography of Ben Franklin, which leads me to ask you, I mean, which historical figures do you find most instructional, helpful? I mean, who are the figures outside of the big three Stoics that you sort of repeatedly look to as your own benchmarks or to learn from?
There's obviously a bunch. In the book, I talked a lot about Ulysses S. Grant, who I thought was really interesting and a sort of a totally underrated, underappreciated historical figure. I talk about John D. Rockefeller, who I thought, you know, and again, all these people have problems. And so I don't want it to descend into like hero worship of any kind. It's you look at the people and you look at the good that they bring to the table and you focus on that, not on, you know, the negative stuff. I talk about Ulysses S. Grant, William Tecumseh Sherman, who is another Civil War general I'm really interested in. I think Richard Feynman is a fascinating character.
Yeah, definitely.
Who asks all sorts of interesting questions. And he had this, what seemed to be this sort of joy and curiosity to him that I appreciate a lot. Cyrus the Great is another really fascinating character who was again one of the most powerful people in the world, but seemed to be universally regarded as a good person and not in like a propagandist way. So those are, you know, those are some of my favorites. I don't think it's a stretch to use fiction either. Like I find it weird that people don't look at fictional characters as either good examples or bad examples.
So who are some of your fictional favorites?
One of my favorite books is this book, What Makes Sammy Run, by Bud Schulberg. It's about this Hollywood screenwriter. It's like a young Jewish kid who's like a total hustler, who's like endlessly ambitious. And it's sort of it's very Gatsby-esque, the book. But the point is, this guy is like hustling and running all the time, but he never stops to question why. And it actually, the moral conclusion of the book is that he gets everything he wanted, and it's like the worst thing that you could ever wish on someone.
Right.
And so that's something like I try to think about a lot too. It's about finding the people that you relate to in fiction or nonfiction, and then seeing what you like about them, like you like about yourself in them, and using that to bring out more of it. And also seeing what you don't like about yourself in them and using it as a cautionary tale.
Right. That's a really good point. Yeah, I have a few books on my bookshelf facing out. I just moved into a new place, so I had the chance to organize my books however I wanted, which was a delightful and extremely time-consuming monkish process for me, being as OCD as I am. But one of them is Zorba the Greek. So
right.
Zorba, it's just such a great cautionary tale for me, because you have like the intellectual slash want to be intellectual who's very introverted and spends too much time tail chasing in his own head versus Zorba, who's so engaged in the moment, et cetera. Very maybe Epicurean in some ways. Yeah, that's really interesting. I also have Dune. I thought, a number of the characters in Dune were very, very interesting. Stranger in a Strange Land as well. So let's look at where you are now, because I've been continually impressed by how, at what a young age you have accomplished certain things, whether that's, responding to, huge responsibilities at American Apparel with marketing, responding to those criticisms publicly, dealing with all sorts of difficulties, not difficulties, but challenges that we all have, but professionally on a pretty public scale. You're 26 now, is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So this is your third book, which, just to put it in a chronology, I mean, the 4-Hour Work Week, I guess it was published or written when I was 29. So you're still 3 years ahead of me with three books. what do you attribute your ability to get shit done? I'm just very curious as to if it's like, well, you blend my two parents and here you are. Like, that's how my parents are. This is how I am. How much is nature versus nurture? I mean, what has contributed to your ability to multitask and also to get this much stuff done at this age? I'm curious to hear your opinion.
Sure. Well, I mean, look, so obviously I had two smart parents. They inculcated in me, a love of reading and questions, and sort of told me I could, do whatever I wanted with my life, like, which was all very helpful. And I wasn't like someone who came from, and I talk about those type of people in the book, the people who came from sort of nothing or worse than nothing, and that's why they were successful. That's not me. And then I had these amazing mentors, which were very helpful. And I also have a big head start on people. I mean, I dropped out of college when I was 19 years old. So I've been doing this for long. Like, most people my age started at 21 or 22.
Right.
So they're sort of just getting started. But, that being said, I think I actually – and the reason I wrote this book is because Stoicism was like – I can trace so much of the good stuff in my life to specific passages in Stoicism that helped me or made me think about, certain things. Like this idea of the obstacle being the way, that there's no such thing as bad things happening to you, that everything is an opportunity to like prove yourself or to do something good is something that's been, enormously beneficial to me. There's also there's a quote in book 5 of Meditations that I used to have printed up on my wall. And it's this conversation where Marcus is sort of actually having it with himself, like it's dialogue, but he's like, so you're waking up in the morning and you're covered in the blankets and you should get up, but you say to yourself, like, but it's so warm here. Like, I want to stay here. And he says, like, but look, you're a human being. Your job is to get up and work. And it's like, what do you mean you've worked enough? Like, would an animal say that? Like, would an animal ever say that they'd done enough work? And then he says, like, you know, people who love what they do wear themselves down doing it. They forget to eat and sleep. They just work because it's not work. It's who they are. And I think for me, getting stuff done has been a function of being able to start having that conversation with myself when I was, you know, 19 years old, rather than like, you know, partying late at night and then waking up hungover every day. Like, I didn't do that. But I really think it's the cumulative process of waking up every day and going to work and like really working and not caring about the rewards or the success, but working because I love what I'm working on. Mm-hmm. That, you know, compounded interest is one of the most powerful forces on earth, right? And you can apply that to your own work. And every day if you wake up and you work on something, you get a little bit closer and it grows. And I think that's, you know, that's been, you write one book, it's easier to write another book, you know? Right. And then you write two books, it makes it easier to write a third book. And I've never been a fan of doing just, I think you're like this too. I don't get how people do just one thing. Like, you're really good at investing, but could you just do that? I don't think that would fulfill you as a person.
Yeah, I couldn't do that alone.
And I think it's weird, but I found that the more things that you're doing, the better. It's like, okay, if you do one thing, you can be really good at it. If you do two things, you feel really busy. But if you do like 3 to 5 things, you're not that busy and they all help each other and make you better at them. So for me, like writing and marketing and like, you know, research and all the things that I was doing at the same time made me better at all of them, and it sped the whole process of learning up really fast.
When you are most productive, how often are you running? Because I know that is another part of your life, or at least historically has been.
Yeah. So, I run almost every day. I started, I run every day, but then I also, you know, from some of your stuff and other people, I know it's not the best thing physically for you. So I usually do CrossFit like 2 days a week. And then I try to swim 1 day a week, and so I run the other days.
Right. Yeah. I found I think long walks are also very underrated.
Totally.
Which we could go through the long list of people who've said that historically.
Yeah. I try not to think about. I definitely don't think of walking that way, and I actually try to not think of running that way. Almost not as exercise. Like I think it's better for your. Has a better impact on your brain than it does on your body.
I agree.
Definitely walking. It's like I've written huge chunks of my books because I went for a walk and then I had a breakthrough that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I think it might be Anand Taleb who also doesn't trust people who won't go for a walk when they speak with him. I could be just making that up, but I'm pretty sure I'm not.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, it sounds about right. Or and then he'll sprint to imagine. What did he say when he has to? Motivate himself to sprint, he will think of like running after the head of the Federal Reserve and smashing them with a baton on the back of their head or something. He's a hilarious guy. Who do you turn to? Actually, let me back up to a separate question. You're a prolific reader. You have a sort of recommended reading list that's quite popular, an email list that people subscribe to.
Yeah.
And I've really been impressed by your synopses of the books that you read. But for someone who is not an avid semi-full-time researcher like yourself,
right.
What are the top, say, you know, 2 or 3 books that you either discovered or delved into while researching The Obstacle is the Way? I mean, if you had to pick your top 2 to 3, you're like, all right, if you want to maximally gain in whatever way, I'll leave it open to you.
Sure.
Read these 2 or 3 books. Like if these are the only 2 or 3 books you read this year, you'll be better off for having.
Okay.
Done so.
Well, I'm looking at the bibliography right now and some that jumped out at me that were total favorites. Ron Chernow's biography of John D. Rockefeller, which is Titan, the Life of John D. Rockefeller, was like a total game changer to me. It was an amazing biography. I like Sarah Bakewell's book, How to Live. It's like a series of essays about Montaigne, who invented the essay.
Yeah.
He's really fascinating. Sarah Bakewell.
Cool.
I like, let's see. Oh, I read this book, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. He was this a totally fascinating but relatively unknown historical figure who started – he started a fruit company buying the day old – not day old, but the about to expire bananas that would be imported in like late 1800s America, and he would sell them by train car. He ends up buying United Fruit. He starts a small fruit company that it grows to be so big that it buys United Fruit Company, which is the biggest fruit company in the world. So that's why he's known as the fish that ate the whale. He's this sort of fascinating Jewish businessman. I read a really good biography of Edison by Matthew Josephson called Edison, A Biography.
Got it.
And if there was any others, I'm trying to think. Yeah, those were some. Oh, and I read a really good biography of Ulysses S. Grant called Ulysses S. Grant, Triumph Over Adversity.
Got it.
That I loved a lot.
Cool. Just writing these down myself. because I need another 20 extra books on my Kindle that I haven't read. I'm just kidding.
Right. I want to give you some more 700-page biographies because I know you need more of those.
Very cool. The Fish That Ate the Whale. That is a fantastic moniker.
Yeah, that one's really short, and you'll really like that guy. He was crazy, and he was like the I can't even describe it. You should just read the book; it's amazing. The writer that wrote it, Rich Cohen, wrote another amazing book called Tough Jews, which was about like JEWS,
right?
About Jewish gangsters, like basically like the people that you see on Boardwalk Empire.
Yep,
he's an amazing writer who you'd really like.
Cool. I view books oftentimes as tools, right?
Yep.
Part of the toolkit for making these better decisions, obviously, and enjoying life at the same time. I do love reading. Are there any other tools that you use or rituals that you have had consistently and found useful? So I'm curious, maybe we can start with the second part of that. What is the first 60 to 120 minutes of your day look like? When do you wake up? What is your morning routine look like? And then maybe we can talk about your daily routine if there is one.
So I try to wake up somewhat early, like 7:30 to 8. I'm not always successful at it. So I try to wake up early and I try not to check my email in the morning if I can, but I'm not usually successful at that either. But, I try to sit down and I write for like the first hour to 2 hours in the morning. Mm-hmm. I find that there's less going on. There's less people bothering you. There's a great writer. He has a site called Farnham Street. His name's Shane Parrish.
What is the name of the site?
Farnham Street, F-A-R-N-A-M.
Okay.
And he wrote an article recently where he's like, look, the number one productivity secret is just wake up early. Yeah. Because there's less going on, you're more productive at the beginning of the day. So I try to get my writing done in the morning, like whatever I'm working on. I try to like bust out an article. If I'm working on a book, I try to tackle a chapter. I try to write in the morning for an hour or two, and then I sort of get to work from then when everyone else is kind of waking up and getting going.
Right. Okay. And then what does your day look like from that point forward?
Yeah, I usually go out to breakfast. I try to eat at the same restaurant every day rather than like, you know, deciding what I want to have for breakfast.
What do you eat?
Usually 3 eggs and 2 sides of bacon. So I get a ton of protein. Mm-hmm. And then I'll have like guacamole or something with it if I want to liven it up a little.
get some non-animal matter.
Yeah, exactly. although I got chickens at my house, so I don't always go out anymore. Sometimes I have fresh eggs at the house.
And you're in Austin.
Yeah, I live in Austin. And then I go to work. Like I have a one index card that I write usually the night before my list of things to do that day. And I try to keep that list like pretty small, like 5 to 7 things usually.
Yep.
And I cross all those things off. They could be small things like email so-and-so, or it could be like, you know, write chapter three. You know, it could be big thing or a little thing. I cross those lists off, those things off. And then the rest of the day is like just responding to stuff that's happening, whether that's emails or phone calls that I've scheduled or meetings that I have to do. I try to avoid as many meetings or phone calls as humanly possible.
How do you go about doing that? Are you diplomatic, or what's your approach to deflecting meeting requests or coffee dates and so on and so forth?
Yeah. Paul Graham actually has a great essay about this called Maker versus Manager.
Oh, it's such a good essay. Yeah, that's a great piece.
But it's really hard, like, if you're someone who fits in this category, when you're both a maker and a manager.
Yeah.
Like most makers are just not good at doing the other thing, so they don't do it. It's hard when you actually have stuff you have to manage. But I just say like, hey, like sometimes I'll just lie. I'll say like, hey, I'm traveling, I can't do the phone. Or, like, hey, I really prefer email. Like, if we can hammer this out over email, it'd be much better. And I know that sometimes email takes longer than doing a phone call because you have to go back and forth.
Yep.
But the point is, it doesn't interrupt what you're doing, and it
right.
does it like on my schedule. So
right.
that's what I just try to be upfront about it. I just say like, hey, like, look, I really hate email. Or I really hate, you know, jumping on the phone. Can we just do this over email? And most people are understanding. And the people that aren't, I either don't care, or I understand that they're more important than me, and they get to dictate the terms, you know?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm glad you brought up the point about, well, number one, I have the exact same habit with index card. That is the finite surface area I find, much like Parkinson's law, helps to refine how you prioritize. But the point you made that I think is really important to underscore, among others, is that just because email might take slightly longer does not mean phone is better. Similarly, you might choose a slightly longer driving route because it's easier to remember and it's more scenic.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
As opposed to being like, yeah, I'm going to sit through like horrible traffic with people honking where I have to really pay attention the whole time and can't daydream, but it's 15 minutes shorter
right.
route. And there's, you know, a really important question, or an important question that I've learned to ask myself, and I'm sure I didn't create this, but I don't remember the attribution if I didn't, and that is, it's not whether you can afford the time or not, it's whether you can afford the distraction.
Yep.
And, you know, that's why it's like, yeah, it might only take you 5 minutes to call someone, but you and I both know if you're writing something or if you're a coder, that could mean you start the clock from zero, and it's going to take you 45 minutes to get back into the flow of what you were doing.
Yeah.
What, speaking of flow and writing, I mean, I think that, you know, I admire your writing because it's a reflection of clear thinking, and I'm wondering what you see as the most common mistakes that writers make. What are some of the most common mistakes where you write for quite a few outlets online, and you're really prolific. You write a lot more than I do, and you know, I'm envious in a way of your output. What are the biggest mistakes that you see writers making, not professionally necessarily,
sure.
but just like stylistically, editorially, what are some of the bigger mistakes, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's weird. I write a lot, but I think I write a lot out of humility. Like, I'm trying to get better, and I think that the only way you do it is by making commitments to write a lot, publishing, and sort of getting feedback.
Yeah.
And like, so I you know, three books in 3 or 4 years is a lot, but plenty of people do more. The articles are designed to make the books better. That's the way that I think about it.
Right.
But I think a couple mistakes that writers make. One, they don't have anything to say. They think that writing is good. Like, they think that writing is the skill that is scarce and good. Like, putting sentences and words together
right.
is good. It's like, look, I would read a biography written by someone with like a 7th grade education if what they were talking about was fascinating. You know, like right. I'm like, have you ever seen that thing where it's like they take a bunch of sentences and they take all the vowels out, or they move the words
right,
around
right,
and you can still read it?
Yep.
Yeah, it's not the technical skill that's rare. It's having something interesting and compelling to say. So I think that's the big thing, is people don't have that much to say, and they focus all their time on technical writing rather than like saying something that's never been said before. Yeah. This maybe ties into that, but I see a lot of writers who start writing before they've figured out exactly what they plan to say and who they're saying it for. Like, they're trying to find the point while they're going.
Right.
And so I use note cards to organize my research, and like, I very rarely write anything that isn't fully outlined and sketched out, especially books. So the writing is the easy part. Figuring out what you have to say and doing the research and bringing something new to the table, that's what's special and rare. Mm-hmm. So I try to – I focus my energy on finding the stories or the thing that I'm bringing to the table that no one else but me could bring. Mm-hmm. And I think far too many writers skip that. And that's why we get these crappy bulleted lists or, you know, on the other hand, like an 8,000-word article that like could have been 20% of the length. And so I think those are mistakes that writers make a lot. I think also just not being honest. I think a lot of people are either pretending and like puffing themselves up with their writing,
right,
or they're hiding something. Like James Altucher, who
I was just going to mention James. He's so good at doing the opposite.
Yeah. He has this rule where he writes the thing that he doesn't want anyone to know about himself. Whatever he's afraid to say, that's what he wants to write an article about. And look, sometimes that ends disastrously and he gets in trouble, but most of the time it creates this vulnerable, authentic voice that people relate to, because no one else is saying these things. And that's what your job as a writer is, to touch something inside of the audience. And you can't do that if you're lying to yourself.
Yeah. No, definitely. Huh. I find writing process just endlessly fascinating.
Totally. Because no one does it the same way.
Yeah, everyone's different. That's one thing I realized really early on. Like, there are best practices for marketing best-selling books. Mm-hmm. There are very, very few consensus about the best way to write a best reading book, if that makes sense. I mean, that's part of the reason why I fell in love with Daily Rituals, which profiles, you know, 170 or so world famous creatives, whether it's writers, composers, scientists, etc., and how their daily schedules are laid out, because they're so different. It's really fascinating to me. Do you watch documentaries? If so, what are your favorite documentaries that come to mind?
I love documentaries, but I don't watch that much like TV, so I don't get to watch as many as I like, because, some favorites. I like Fog of War, I think is amazing. Mm-hmm. That Phil Spector documentary from a couple years ago was pretty crazy. I think it's called The Wall of Sound, but I forget what it's called exactly. Mm-hmm. There's the guy who did Fog of War has a new one out about Donald Rumsfeld that I want to see. Called the Unknown Known. Hmm. I love Ken Burns. I've watched like pretty much every Ken Burns documentary you could ever see, including all 10 hours about the Civil War and all 10 hours about the national park system. So I think like what I love when you like, I love any art where the person doing it is clearly like the master of their craft.
Right.
And to me, Ken Burns is like the best person who ever lived at documentaries. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how anyone could beat him. And so it's like, I'll watch, you know, 10 hours about national parks, like, because it's that good, even if you don't care.
Right.
So I think I love his stuff.
Yeah. That's it's funny you mentioned that. That's how I feel about John McPhee as a nonfiction writer.
Totally.
I mean, he's for those people who don't know who he is, he's a, at least a one-time, maybe a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And I was fortunate enough to have him in seminar for nonfiction writing called the class was called The Literature of Fact when I was an undergrad for 1 year, which was amazing. It was really hilarious too to get back a 3-page writing assignment and to have more red ink from him on the page than black ink. you really feel like a dumbass when you realize how sloppy your thinking is when you get something like that back. But you know, he's written books on everything from an entire book on oranges, an entire book on one tennis match, yep. An entire book on hand-carved wooden canoes, a book on Plymouth Rock. I mean, it's just the breadth is so amazing. But if it's written by him, I just don't care. If it was a book on chopsticks, I'd be like, absolutely, I'll read a 200-page, 300-page book on chopsticks written by John McPhee.
Right. I love – he has that one Control of Nature that's really fascinating. That's just about like – it's like about the Mississippi River, some volcano in Iceland, and like – the hills of Los Angeles. And you're like, this should not be fascinating, but like I'm hanging on every word because you're so good.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, chances are he's been writing for so long. He's been a staff writer at The New Yorker for decades and decades and decades. I think he's got to be in his 70s or 80s even now. But I remember researching The 4-Hour Chef and I was like, I bet there's something that McPhee has written on cooking and food, and I bet it's going to be one of the best pieces in the English language. And lo and behold, there is this piece from sometime in the maybe 80s called Brigade de Cuisine, written about this tiny restaurant in New York and just this maniac executive chef. And it was it's like, all right, there we go. Like, yep, the best I've ever read about cooking or food. And of course, it's John McPhee. Yeah.
So, totally.
What are some of your goals for this year? I'm very curious to know if do you believe in resolutions that are long-term resolutions? Is it tiny habits day by day? I mean, what are some of your goals, whether for this year or shorter term? I mean, how do you, or longer term for that matter?
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. It's not that I don't believe in goals. It's actually been a weird, and this sounds, I'm sure, like a humble brag, but it's a genuine problem. So, or a first world problem. Like I wanted to write books. Like that's what I wanted to do. And, I wanted to be a writer. That was my
that's
thing.
That's what you wanted to be even growing up. Is that what you thought you were doing?
Right. Yeah. And so I accomplished it very early and now it's like, okay, now what? I don't have like, well, now I want to be the biggest author in the world. Like part of one of the benefits and then also consequences, I guess, of Stoicism is that it's very humbling and it sort of helps filter out like very selfish or materialistic goals, I would say. So like I'm not like, oh, I want to have millions of dollars or I want to have hundreds of millions of dollars. Like it's like I'm quite comfortable. I would like to continue to be comfortable, but like that ambition is somewhat sated. I have more book ideas, so I'm in the process of thinking about and potentially selling another book. Mm-hmm. But I'd like it to take longer, and I'd like to challenge myself in ways that way. I may get married. Well, I'm engaged. I'll probably get married this year. So that's like something I think. Like in a lot of ways,
I would hope you would have some plans for getting married, or if there was just like, no, I figured out the engaged part, but I'm not sure on the marriage part. Right.
Right. Well, no, it's like a
hold option.
Yeah. Right. Now I've got some time. I bought myself some time.
The option agreement of the girlfriend.
Right. I locked it down and now I'm just going to wait. I think I would like to focus on like less sort of external goals and maybe more internal goals. Just like, you know, I don't think there's anyone out there that's like, I'm exactly as like low stress as I want. I'm exactly as sort of like kind or forgiving as I want. I'm exactly as, you know, like happy. Like I'd like to focus on sort of internal personal stuff. In terms of adjust, like integrating and adjusting all the things that have come into my life over the last 2 years into the kind of like everyday norm that I would like. So it's not a specific thing, and that might hold me back in some ways. But I think it's less about like sort of external publicly validated success, and more about just like, all right, is this the person that I want to be? Well, kind of, but here are three or four things I would fix. Well, let's focus on those.
Right. So two related questions that are follow-ups. The first is, if you want to be a writer and you write a lot, you mentioned one of the problems with a lot of writers is they just don't have anything to say. How does one go about having something interesting or meaningful to say? And how do you do that? Let's begin with that. And then I have a question about working on internal goals.
Sure. So the best writing advice I ever got, and I think it came from Tucker, but I don't remember, but someone asked him, like, how do you become a writer? And he said, writers live interesting lives. And that's how you find something to say. Like, you go and do interesting. And yes, this is true for fiction or nonfiction. Go do interesting things, experience the world, and develop some sort of perspective or knowledge or wisdom that you can pass along through your writing. So the 4-hour work week came from your experiences running a company and then deciding to travel. Right. And you know, my first book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, came out of my experiences in marketing and doing a specific kind of marketing and having a sort of existential crisis that came along with that. And this book came out of my studies and experiences, you know, like researching and reading and just living my life in a high pressure, high stakes environment. And I know that seems weird, but just like the best marketing decision you can make for a product is to like have a really good product that people want, the best way to have writing that people want is to live a life and have experienced the world in a way that allows you to communicate something to people that they've never heard before. And and I think it's actually especially true in fiction because you're like, at least in nonfiction, you can like someone could go out and study and objectively find, like academics can write good nonfiction books based on their research. But nonfiction, you have to be able to communicate all these intangibles to the reader.
You mean fiction?
Yeah, sorry, in fiction, yeah. You have to communicate all these intangibles about life and about relationships and about how the world works. And if you haven't gone out and lived it and experienced it, you're at a distinct disadvantage when it comes to communicating those things because it's like you're like the 40-year-old virgin who's trying to like talk about sex.
Right, like a bag of sand. It felt like a bag of sand.
Right. You can fake it. You can fake it until you say something that's so obviously wrong that just everyone in that instance knows that you have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, good point. And I mean, that's been really my maybe way of compensating for what I perceive as a very imperfect writing style. I don't think that I am the best writer out there. I view myself as a teacher first and foremost. So my cheat has been to follow in the footsteps of someone like George Plimpton, who is a really fascinating character, who's the editor of the Paris Review and really popularized what he called participatory journalism, where he would go become professional football player for a season. He would go try to join the circus for a season. He would go try to box three rounds with Archie Moore, for instance, and then write about the experience. And you do not need, just to underscore what you said, you do not need to be a college-educated wordsmith to have compelling writing if you have a good story to tell. It's just that simple. And you know, I remember talking with Tucker about this, and you know, a lot of it really just comes down to, I think, writing in a natural voice, basically writing as you are, which takes practice, but having a good story to tell. Working on, actually, before I get to the internal goals, what does financial security mean to you? How do you define that for you, for yourself personally?
Are we talking like specific numbers, or are we just talking about like what is financial security sort of generally?
You know, but you know, both, to the extent that you're comfortable. I mean, it's,
sure.
You know, it's whatever you're comfortable talking about. It's just that I think this is such a huge piece of so many decisions that people make, bad and good. So I'd be curious to know how you have sort of resolved this for yourself to the extent that you have.
Sure. Well, I guess there's a couple ways to be rich, right? One is have a lot of money so you can buy a lot of stuff. or the second, or like if you sort of express being rich as being able to buy whatever it is that you want, right, whenever you want it, there's two ways to do that. One is to have tons of money, or two is to not want as much stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think if you meet somewhere in the middle where you sort of you keep your tastes under control, like for instance, like I don't fly first class. I could afford it, but I don't fly first class because, and I have before, but the point is like I just don't want to get in a habit of flying first class because now it means like if I want to travel somewhere, it's going to cost me X amount,
right?
And I'm going to have to do things that I maybe don't want to do to be able to get that money.
Right.
And I'm going to make decisions for the rest of my life around that assumption. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to have to do that. So it's like, how do you limit what you, like there's that quote from Paul Graham about keeping your identity small. If you can keep your tastes at a level at which a reasonable salary or financial situation covers it, then you don't need to go out and do certain things for money that other people do. Like to me, financial success is like I have a house that I live in that's nice, that I can keep my stuff in, that I have my books in, but I don't have like six spare bedrooms that I needed to fill up with furniture because I wanted to send a message to people that I have a really nice house, you know?
Right.
And I don't live in New York City because I don't need to live in New York City. And which means that I spend a lot less just to have the same thing, you know? Right. And like, it's like, can I go to a nice steakhouse and buy whatever I want and not care what the check is? To me, that's being financially secure and about sort of what I need to not care about money.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
And so like, and then I think the other, it's not just being financially smart on your spending, but like, you know, do you actually understand like investing and managing your money in a smart way so it's not, you know, like there's all these people, I'm sure you deal with investors or startup founders or whatever who have like credit card debt. And it's like, why are you trying to like invest in startups when you could just make 13% more a year by not paying off your, by not like having, carrying a credit card balance? You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So I think just sort of basic financial responsibility and management helps you make what you're doing go further. Mm-hmm. So like that's been beneficial to me. But there, you know, there's the study about you know, if you make more than any amount over $70,000 a year does not correlate with any increased amount of happiness. Mm-hmm. I think that's definitely true, having made a lot more than $70,000 a year and a lot less. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's like, you know, somewhere above that is happy and comfortable, and the rest should be saved and managed, like the Stoics say, for a much worse time, because you never know what's going to happen. Don't spend the money you make because you might not have it and you might want it some other time.
Sage advice. Yeah, it's hard to predict, nay, impossible to predict when the next black swan will hit.
Totally.
And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this, not to misdirect the conversation, but the fact that much like human action and climate change, technology, in a sense, has led to superstorms, let's say storms of the century, perhaps happening as often as every 3 to 20 years now, which was a recent piece that came out of MIT, the instantaneous dissemination of hysteria through mm-hmm. social media, I think, greatly increases the probability of higher frequency black swans, because everything is so interconnected, and humans are, for better or for worse, certainly in large numbers, pretty irrational masses. And I just feel like, if anything, you know, these sort of once a century, twice a century stock market crashes and so on are probably mm-hmm. going to happen more often. But that's pure speculation on my part.
No, I think it makes sense. And it's like, look, do you want to, like, what I quote this in the book, there's the line from Warren Buffett about being greedy when others are fearful and being fearful when others are greedy. And we definitely live in a time where people are very greedy. And I think it's really important too that you don't at all correlate being financially successful with worth as a person. So the fact that, you know, I know someone who's worth X million and I know someone who's worth, you know, less than nothing doesn't say anything about their value to me as people and how I should respect or treat them. And if you can keep that in mind, you won't feel like the fact that so-and-so is making, you know, $80,000 a month on info products. Mm-hmm. It doesn't like I know this, but it doesn't make me care about making info products. Like, I want to write my books because they pay me enough to be happy. And that's what matters.
So speaking of sort of the valuing people and different people, feel free to answer this however you like. For your circle of friends, number one, you know, these days, how do you curate them, right? If it's not on net worth, which is, yeah, I agree, it shouldn't be.
Right.
How do you curate your friends that you end up being the average of, right, as a group? Mm-hmm. And over time, let's just say over the last 5 years, 10 years, what has become more important and less important or less important?
It's weird. I think a big part of it is keeping like toxic, unhealthy people out of your life, like people who have drama and problems and pathological issues. I think those are important people, not only not to be friends with, but to, you know, extricate yourself from as much as possible. So that's something I've thought a lot about. I like people who make me laugh. I think that's important. I think people who I don't have to try to impress. Like, it was weird. One of my friends from high school was in town like over the weekend, and it was like, I don't think we talked about like work at all, because he was doing his thing and I'm doing my thing. And what matters is that we have like a shared history or a thing that we relate over. Mm-hmm. And so to me, like, I don't know about you, where when your work is also tied up in your personal relationships, I really value people who I can exist in the present moment with. So it's like, I can do something with them. I can have a conversation with them. And it doesn't, like, the fact that, you know, they do this and I do this is irrelevant. And the fact that they live here and I live here is irrelevant. I look for people that, like, I may have gotten this for you, is like the idea of someone you can sit and have a nice long dinner with. To me, that's a friend, mm-hmm. not someone I have to meet at a bar or, you know, any other context.
Makes perfect sense. If you had to pick, let's do just a couple of rapid fire questions.
Okay.
And one to think on, just as we're doing this, is I'd like to hear a story of what Aisha Tyler calls self-inflicted wounds. So just like a ridiculous story, a debacle, a fiasco of some type that was self-created. Sometimes that's involving alcohol for people. That doesn't have to be true for you, since I don't think I'm not sure if I've ever seen you drink alcohol. Okay, first one, what would be your theme song or your like ring entrance music if you had to choose one?
Let me pull up iTunes. Let me see if I have anything. I don't know. I like Iron Maiden. If I had to pick like an awesome entrance song, probably something from Iron Maiden.
Okay. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
This is ironic. I don't love my voice that much.
Mm, I feel the same way. Not about your voice, but about mine.
Do you think there's any like anyone who's not like a narcissist that enjoys the sound of their own recorded voice?
I haven't yet met them, but I'm sure they exist.
I heard it's actually because you hear your voice differently. Like, apparently it's like when you're just talking, the voice that you hear is different than like how it's recorded, and it's just the difference that makes you feel bad about yourself.
You know, that's an enabling belief, so I'll take it.
Sure.
thanks for that. When you think of the word successful, who is the first person who comes to mind and why?
No one comes to mind. Well, I talk about John D. Rockefeller in the book, so there's an example, one of the world's richest men.
Got it. All right. If you could study a new subject with any expert in the world, who would it be and what would you study?
Like a new subject or just a subject different than the one that I study?
By new, I mean new to you. So yeah, different from what you've already immersed yourself in.
Yeah, I think I'd love to do like archaeology or something like that. I don't know a specific person, but some sort of ancient site or dig would be fascinating to me.
And you spent time in Rome looking at like the burial site of Seneca and so on. Is that right?
Yeah. I spent some time in Rome when I was finishing up the book, and I just went to like the sites and stuff that are in the book for sure. And I was in Dublin. I was in Dublin like 2 weeks ago. You'll love this. They took us into this crypt, like a burial site that preserves the bodies, and they had these mummies there from like the 12th century, and they let us touch them.
Wow!
I was like, we are a long ways from America. Like, are you kidding? We touched the hand of this guy who died in the Crusades.
Wow! Yeah, that's. That would definitely be cordoned off in the U.S.
I think so, yeah.
Do not chew on the mummy. If you could offer your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be? Let's place that. Yeah. Younger self, freshman in college.
Relax.
Relax. Why?
Every young person that I think you probably get this too. Every young person that I talk to, I feel, especially like an ambitious one that seems to want to talk to me, I feel like they're on the verge of like a nervous breakdown or an explosion of some kind. because everything is so serious to you when you're that age. And I think maybe it's our parents that did it to us or whatever, but I feel they're like, you know, if I got to do this or like I'm going to die. Like it's like everything feels like an issue of life or death, you know?
Right.
And it's so the opposite of that. It's like you could in all of history, you are in the safest, most like nerf, like bumpered area that has ever existed. Like you could do anything short of murder and you're probably going to be fine. You know what I mean? Like you have unlimited time, like just relax, take it easy. You're not going to care about this in a little bit of time. And that's probably what I would tell myself.
So just to take a quick sidebar from the rapid fire, you dropped out of college. I feel like there is a survivorship bias in media that leads to a romanticizing of dropping out of college. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on who you would advise to drop out of college, who you would advise to stay in college, because you ended up very uniquely in my experience, extremely well-read and extremely well-rounded. Mm-hmm. And when people drop out of college, oftentimes they say, well, it's because it's not going to prepare me for job X or Y or Z.
Right.
In my opinion, at least in a liberal arts college, still is that the goal is not to prepare you for a single career. The goal is to make you a well-rounded, developed human being. So I'd just be curious to know what your caveats are, who you would recommend consider dropping out versus not.
Yeah. So it's funny. I was looking at there's a Wikipedia page that's like a list of college dropout billionaires.
Right.
And it's funny. It's like, it's the definition of the survivor bias because there's like, let's say there's 500 billionaires in the world and like 20 of them were college dropouts. That means even among billionaires, most of them went to college, right? So, but you only care about the ones who dropped out of college. So, I think like for me, dropping out of college was a pretty simple calculation. It was, would I stay in college and graduate and hope to have this same opportunity that I'm being offered right now?
And the answer was, and that was the Tucker opportunity.
It was Tucker, Robert Greene, and then working for Aaron Ray, who we both know at the Collective in Hollywood. So it was three things that either one of them individually I would have killed for as a post-grad job. And so I said, you know, I'm going to do this now and see how it goes. What I think the problem with dropping out of college that everyone misses in the discussion is that dropping out of college is not a thing. you take a leave of absence from college, meaning you can go back at essentially any time. So the it's again, when I'm saying like relax to the 19-year-old version of me or whatever, it's like, dude, it's not as black and white as you're making it out to be. Like, take risks. You're in a cohort where you can absorb risk, and then understand that you're not going to starve to death if this goes poorly. Like, for me, it was like, I'm going to take advantage of this, and a year from now, if it's not working out, I'm going to go back to college, because college is the best default option if you don't know what you want to do, because it keeps you on the level with everyone else, and it gives you some sort of certification that sets you apart from like people who didn't go to college.
Right.
So that's how I think about college. And usually, and I'll say this, the people who should not drop out of college are the people who are doing poorly in college, because college is exactly like life. It's a system that you have to figure out how to get the most out of.
Yep.
And do your best at. And if you're failing out of college, you are probably going to fail at life, because you are, if you don't address the root reasons why you're doing bad at college, you know?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, learn to game the system while you still have headgear on. Before
exactly.
Cool. All right. I appreciate that, because it's something that I get asked about a lot. So it's nice to have your input. All right.
Note on that. It's like I always hear from people, it's like, oh, I want to leave college so I can travel, or I want to go to college so I can like start a company or get a mentorship. And it's like, these are not things that you have to leave the womb to do. Like, you can do them in college.
Right.
And
right.
So you should leave college if you have an opportunity to do something that can only be done outside of college, and if you will kick yourself if you let that opportunity pass and it doesn't come back your way again when you're graduating.
Yeah, and that's a great point, actually. I think that it would be very fascinating to look at billionaire dropouts and see how many of them had started the company that was going to later make them a billionaire, and proven to themselves that it had very real legs and a time sensitive window before they dropped out. Because I think the percentage is probably very high.
Right. That's what Zuckerberg did.
Yeah. Yeah. And many others. Awesome. So we'll take just a little bit more time. I'm going to do a couple of rapid fire so people get to know you and not just your thoughts on stoicism. All right. So you walk into a bar. What do you order from the bartender?
If it's in Austin, I order Topo Chico, which is like a Mexican sparkling water. If it's not Austin, I'll probably just get soda water with lemon and lime or cider.
Do you ever drink?
Just cider. It's the only thing that I like.
Got it. So it's not a moral decision. It's a taste decision.
It's a little of both, but yeah.
Okay. what makes Mexican sparkling water different from normal sparkling water? I have to ask.
I just like it better than Pellegrino, but I will say that I fully embrace the ridiculousness of eating or of drinking imported water from Mexico.
Especially Mexico. All right.
Right.
Who is your favorite person to follow on Twitter, and you can give two or three if you'd like.
I like fake Jeff Jarvis, who I think is hilarious. I like Felix Salmon a lot.
Who is Felix?
Felix Salmon, he's a blogger for Reuters.
Got it.
And then I don't know who else. Oh, Media Redefined by Jason Hirschhorn is a pretty good Twitter feed to follow. And Maria Popova of Brain Pickings.
Yeah, that's a great site. Speaking of sites, what sites do you visit on a regular basis?
I don't visit a ton of sites. I use my RSS reader. So I use Feedly, where I've subscribed to a bunch of feeds. Felix is one of my favorite. I like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who blogs for The Atlantic. I like Mark Cuban's blog a lot. I think Reddit, if you subscribe to the right subreddits, is a really good way to get like sort of highly curated news.
What subreddits do you subscribe to?
Stoicism
besides,
is a good one.
Besides Not Suitable for Work.
Yeah, sure. Stoicism is a good one. Philosophy is a decent one. History porn is a pretty good one, which is just like old photos from history.
Yeah.
Ask historians is my favorite. So smart people, people ask unusual questions about history that only like academics or historians answer. Mm-hmm. Today I Learned is a great one, where it's just like a fact that, you know, people was unexpected. Mm-hmm. I like First World Problems. I think that's a funny one. And then is there any, there's one about Civil War. There's one about writing. And then I like Reddit books as well.
Yeah. Reddit books is big.
Yeah.
What is the first face that comes to mind when you think punchable?
Punchable. I don't know. That's a good question though.
We can come back to that. It could be a fictional character too, if you'd like.
Sure.
Dogs or cats?
Dogs, of course.
Why?
Cats are just an animal that lives in your house.
Got it. And okay, so elaborate on dogs, because you said something to me that I was hoping to have you elaborate on, was that dogs, you think dogs make you a better person. I was curious how you think they make you a better person.
Dogs exist totally in the moment. Dogs are the definition, I think, of sort of unconditional affection. And I think it's really interesting to have an animal that evolved to live and depend on humans the way that dogs did. Like dogs, they think were domesticated because they, like wolves would come and eat scraps from the like the campfire. And basically we slowly selected the most sort of docile, friendly, you know, mischievous of the animals, and that's where dogs come from. So I think dogs are great because they're this thing that's dependable, or this thing that depends on you and needs you, but at the same time you can never truly disappoint. So it's this great sort of metaphor for life. I think it's just great practice. And plus they're super cute and they do like hilarious things. I have two pet goats also. I don't know if I told you this, but I
no.
I have two goats which are pretty funny. They're like really dumb dogs.
Do you milk the goats, or do you just have them for comedic effect?
Just mostly for comedic effect. Like I don't like people have asked that, but I just don't have that much need for goat's milk, so it's not. You have to breed them to get, because they're Nigerian dwarf goats, so you have to breed them to get milk, which I'm not really interested in doing.
Sounds really low yield. It's kind of like milking cats.
Right. Like, what do I need? Then I'm just this guy who's always trying to pawn goat milk on people. Like, let me give you some.
Right, right.
Like the friend as that has delicious an orange as tree.
Nigerian dwarf goat milk sounds. Yeah. That could become a thing in San Francisco. You could export
probably.
It. Yeah. What book are you most likely to give out as a gift?
Probably Meditations. God knows how many copies I've gone through. And then the second one would be The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
Yeah, it's a great book. Let's see. What movie can you not resisting if it's on, assuming that you had a TV in an imaginary world?
Well, of course, I have a TV. I'm not a weirdo. I love TV. I probably Gladiator.
It's appropriate.
I like Spinal Tap's one of my favorite movies.
Have you seen Shaun of the Dead?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. You have to see Shaun of the Dead. S-H-A-U-N.
It
might become one of your favorite movies. It is.
All right.
It is splendid. I wrote about half of the 4-hour work week with that on repeat on a TV.
Yeah, I don't know how you do that. I have to have total silence.
Well, here's where I am a weirdo, among many other ways, is I would play the movie because I tend to write late at night, and it's easy to feel isolated and crazy and like Nicholson in The Shining.
Right.
If you're always by yourself, at least for me, so particularly without any dogs or anything around or people. So I would put the movies on with characters that I liked, and I would mute the TV and then listen to music while that is just human motion, human forms and motion in the background. Oddly enough. Yeah. Just a habit that I have. Let's see. Who was your first celebrity crush, if you've had one?
Celebrity crush.
Or current celebrity crush. Any celebrity crush.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Nicolas Cage?
Yeah. I'm a big Nicolas Cage fan.
Do you cook?
Like, I cook bacon.
Okay, I can't end on that question right. and answer. if you could choose three people, let's just say living people,
okay,
to be your sort of circle of advisors or elders to help you with major decisions, who would they be?
It's weird. Like, so I've gotten an iteration of that question where it's like, oh, you've worked with all these people. Who else would you want to work with that you haven't?
Yeah.
And I, it's weird. I feel like very fortunate that I haven't. Like, Robert Greene is one of the sort of most respected, you know, strategists about power and life and history. And like, he's someone that I call when I have questions about stuff. You know, I think you're one of those people that I call, and you're a, you know, a world renowned writer and marketing expert and an investor. And then the third person is my girlfriend now fiance, who I think is really good at sort of reading people. And more importantly, she knows me and like what my weaknesses or issues are. Which I think is really important. It's not just about like, you know, objectively what the best thing to do in a situation is.
Absolutely.
It's like what can you do given your constraints or tendencies? Like, oh, you should totally take this job. Well, you know, if you're someone who's pretty flaky, that's not a great, you know, that's not great advice. Like it's oftentimes it's, you know, what you can do with your taking you as a person for granted, who's going to behave how you've always behaved. You can have someone who understands you well enough to give really good advice. I think that's super important.
So I think that is a great note to wrap up on. How can people better or best get to know Ryan Holiday? Where should they find you online? What should they read of yours?
Sure.
Give us some suggestions so that people can dig a little deeper, which I hope they do.
Yeah. So my website is ryanholiday.net. I'm Ryan Holiday on Twitter. I suggest people start with the books too, because I put myself into the books. So The Obstacle is the Way. Trust Me, I'm Lying is my first book. I did a book called Growth Hacker Marketing, which started as a Kindle book, and now it's going to be a paperback. And then I write, you know, almost weekly for Thought Catalog. And then I'm the editor at large of the New York Observer, where I have a series of columns about media and life and other things there.
Fantastic. Well, Ryan, thanks for the time. Always nice to chat. And this gives me an excuse to sort of ask you 20 questions in a way that isn't totally socially weird over a meal. So
this was amazing.
Yeah, this was super fun. I will, I'm sure, talk to you soon. So thanks. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, Ryan, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
If you want more of The Tim Ferriss Show, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or go to 4hourblog.com.
F-O-U-R-H-O-U-R-B-L-O-G.com.
Where you'll find an award-winning blog, tons of audio and video interview stories with people like Warren Buffett and Mike Shinoda from Linkin Park, the books, plus much, much more. Follow Tim on Twitter. It's twitter.com/tferriss. That's
T-F-E-R-R-I-S-S.
Or on Facebook at facebook.com/timferriss. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.